Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets are all a flutter. Oil spikes on Mideast tensions. Yields crash on central bank dovishness. And my luncheon with Ben Bernanke. All this and much more on episode number 617 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey there. How are you? This is Andrew Horowitz. I'm the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as the founder of Horowitz & Company, investment advisors and financial planners. And I'm glad you're with me today. On this Sunday, where are we? We're in the latter part of June, the 23rd of June, 2019, the last full week of the month, the last full week of the quarter. So there'll be a lot of things going on in the markets that we're going to have to keep an eye on, because we know that, and we've talked about this 100 times over the past number of years, that you know, this is a time in the markets where you see a lot of window dressing. You see a lot of movement in the markets so that you can book whatever it is that you want on your reports of what you own, what you don't own, what you don't want to be seen to be sharing out there. And that's really dealing with the mutual funds and institutional money managers. But there's some shenanigans that take place over the next week or so. So keep an eye on that. And with a great quarter, with a really good month, I don't know if there's going to be a lot of movement, but you may see some movement in the IPO markets and less liquid markets that many of the investment groups are trying to show that they've had some of the best performers during that period. Well, we also welcome you to the summer here. It is that time of year. Yes, the summer solstice, which occurred on June 21st, officially marks the start of summer. And for those of you that are listening in the north, those of you that are in the Arctic Circle, if there are anybody, I doubt it. You know, you're enjoying 24 hours of sun right now. I did look at this, and down here in Florida, we get about 14 hours of sun at the peak on June 21st. And I probably somewhere in the north, if you're in, let's say, north of Virginia, probably getting about 16 hours up through New York, and that's kind of the medium point, somewhere around there. So hopefully you're enjoying some of that extra sunlight and, you know, enjoying the summer, because here we are. It's kind of hot down here. Well, what does that actually mean for markets? Absolutely nothing. But it's interesting because there are a lot of people in the business that actually make a living trying to predict what markets are going to do, dependent on certain components of, let's call it, weather and aberrations in climate. For example, there's some people that look at the lunar pull and how that may change the psychology of investors. And there is definitely a group of people that look at sunspots. And they're looking at this to try to understand more about how sunspots impact. They do a projection of when sunspots are supposed to occur and when the height and the greatest number of sunspots are going to show occurrences, and plot that with a lag on a chart and show how there is a change in market sentiment during that time, because there is some kind of impact on us human beings down here on planet Earth that are somehow being affected by these sunspots. And by looking at that, it could show our proclivity to potentially be in a good mood, bad mood, or buy stocks or sell stocks. I call BS. I call total BS on this. Doesn't seem really, I don't know. What do you think about that? Is there those that can actually predict market action, market movement, and trend by sunspots or by lunar gravitational pull or by, I don't know, anything else? Maybe certain stars aligning in the sky at certain times of the year? Maybe the summer solstice? I doubt it. But if you do want to tell me about it, maybe share some of your thoughts on that. You could always go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click on the Ask Andrew button on top there and send me your comments. A lot of you do, and I really enjoy what you have to say. This is, of course, a two-way operation, not just me here in the studio. This is a new studio. How do I sound? Got a couple of little kinks in the new software that we put on. Now I switched over to Windows from my Mac, and we're recording it with a whole different recording setup. Hopefully this will sound good. We'll tweak it out a little bit over time, and hopefully it will gain some opportunity for a better sound as we tweak it out. But here we are. Let's talk about the week, because it's a pretty interesting week. I mean, when you have two central banks totally turning tail, totally reversing what they had talked about just a matter of 6 months ago, where they were all considering, you know, the economy's doing really well and things are doing well, and what we're going to do is we're going to start raising rates or continue to raise rates because we don't see any reason why the economy can't sustain the continued growth that we've seen with a couple of more rate hikes. And even Europe, who has been in, I would say, a non-growth status, just kind of treading water, they even talked about it. ECB's Mario Draghi talked about, hey, you know what? We're going to raise rates as well. We need to do so because we want to stay ahead of the potential for inflation and all the other things. This is a guy who's extraordinarily dovish, and he's been so historically. And back in, we'll say, the fourth quarter or so of 2018, he was even talking about raising rates. Not the Bank of Japan. Nope. They never talk about raising rates. They haven't talked about raising rates in the last 20 years that has any significance or any real life application. A couple of little things here and there. But, you know, generally speaking, they're on a quantitative easing infinitum and buying up ETFs in the markets and doing their best to suppress their currency value. And that's what they're going to do. And that's what they're going to stay doing. So here we are a few months later, and all of a sudden the Fed is starting to send out signals. They're sending out the parade of Fed speakers talking about all the different things with regard to, you know, looking at the dot plots and being more focused on the economic numbers, not being on a pre-planned rate hike mission. And here we are. And you have to wonder if what we've seen in the markets, not only in the equity markets, but primarily in the fixed income markets, if in fact what we're seeing right now is the tail wagging the dog. I mean, it really does appear to me that the markets are dictating what the Fed is going to do. And I don't know, is it possible that maybe that the bond market these days has the ability to actually move the Fed rather than the Fed being in charge of moving the markets? You know, that's what we've seen for some time, right? The Fed would be the one that would pronounce a rate hike, a rate cut, a rate direction. They would talk about, you know, where things were, their outlooks. And I think that what we're seeing right now is while we have this this communication strategy or this forward guidance strategy that's going on right now that the Fed is very proud of, that possibly there is some of the markets are really pushing the Fed. And as you see that there hasn't been a change in rates and you see there hasn't been a change in any of the quantitative easing structure here in the United States of any significance, it's possible that maybe these algos that are out there are really being tweaked in a way to push on the string and that forces and creates the bond market in a direction that the Fed is hinting at, but to a degree that it forces the Fed's hand, that it makes them actually follow along. And maybe possibly what's happened is that they've gotten smart and they've gone after certain areas in the yield curve, forced it to invert, thereby telling the Fed that, you know what, this is going to continue and cause a lot of problems for the economy unless you do something. And backing the Fed into a corner and pushing them to actually make a rate change in favor of what the markets are saying. I mean, it's possible, right? Anything's possible. And there's enough money floating around with the excessive amount of liquidity that's out there right now in the markets. It seems like it's pretty, it doesn't seem far-fetched. And what does this all mean? Well, we're going to get some artificial move in the markets that are in advance of where the Fed believes we are. There's this expectation that we have 3 cuts in the next year. That's what's being priced into the markets. And 100% chance, 100% chance of a rate cut. And that's all good for the markets. And this rate cut, 100%, it's in July, right? So it's only a month away. Fed came out this week, talked more about their potential, that there was some people that talked about a rate cut, but they're holding their rates right now. We saw the ECB come out and say, hey, we're going to do whatever it takes again. That dropped their currency. That made everybody all excited. And again, liquidity is very high in the markets from a perceived standpoint and a reality standpoint. So you got both things that are going on right now. And where do people go? Well, they're looking for yield. So they're going to push on the U.S. bonds because we have how many trillions of dollars of negative yielding instruments around the world right now? And so the best deal is clearly the U.S. when it comes to quality and yield. But I was thinking, are yields at the right level? Are rates at the right level where we are? It seems a little bit preposterous to me, but just for a moment, I was thinking, let's do a little exercise. You can close your eyes if you want. A lot of times you hear people, close your eyes for this exercise. You don't need to close your eyes, especially if you're driving, but I want you to clear your mind for a second. Just play along. And I want you to pretend for a second that you're an economist and you're stranded on an island with no communications for the last 10 years. You know nothing about what's going on. Your daily main mission, what do you need to do? You need to find shelter. You need to find food. And need to try to figure a way to put an SOS sign in the sand in order to make sure that if anybody passes over, that you are going to be rescued. You got to have an area on top of a mountain somewhere that you have a big fire ready to go that you can go up there if you see some kind of plane or something flying overhead, and maybe even a ship out in the distance that you can light up and signal them, right? I took that all from, of course, Castaway, the movie Castaway with Tom Hanks. But think about that, right? So you're on a stranded island. You're stranded on an island. No one's around. You don't got any newspapers or TV or any kind of notion of what's happening in the world. Your island is your world. And all of a sudden, miracle of miracles, you're rescued. You go home. And for a little while, you're sheltered. You're kind of trying to reorient yourself. You still don't know what's going on with interest rates or bonds, Fed fund rates, or any of the rates around the world. You kind of still just, and they put you in a room. They sequester you. They're going to kind of debrief you. And what they want to do is present you, and I'm going to present you with economic data and ask you to come up with your best guess as an economist with the underlying data that I'm about to provide you of what interest rates should be for the Fed and for the 10-year Treasury. So here we are sitting in a room talking about economic numbers, and here are the facts that are laid out in front of you. Unemployment's at 3.6%. Weekly initial claims are in the 215,000 or so range. Manufacturing and services in the low 50s, but yet that is still meaning that it's an expansion rather than a contraction under 50. So we're over 50, and that's good. The stock market is at or close to all-time highs. Housing prices in major cities are at or close to all-time highs. GDP is running at about 2%, 2.5% on an annualized basis or so. Inflation is near 2%. Consumer confidence is near the top of the historic range. Retail sales are a little sluggish, but they're positive. And credit spreads are tight, which is good and a sign of a healthy economy. So first question I ask you now is, with all those facts I laid out, without any other knowledge of what's going on, would you predict that the Fed funds rate is 4% near the long-term average, 5% above average, 3%, which is kind of below average, or 2.5%, 2.25%, 2.5%, which is close to emergency stimulus measures levels when we've seen them in emergency times? That's the first question. You're going to ponder that and think, well, I don't know about your answer. Now think about your answer. Say it out loud or think it out loud in your head. Fed funds rates, where are they? With all that information. The second question regarding 10-year treasuries, the benchmark bond for U.S. treasuries. Again, with the information we have here, so where do we think this is going to be? Would you say that the 10-year is yielding 5%, 4%, 3%, or 2%? I mean, I'm thinking, and I'll put a little wager on there. I bet that the fact patterns that you're finding as an economist in the situation we just talked about is you'd probably agree that, well, rates should be a little bit higher, maybe in the 4% range or so, maybe 5%. We would think that even though inflation is not an issue right now, that maybe there is, some reasonable level of long-term historic averages that we're close to in terms of rates on the Fed funds rates. And probably when it comes to the 10-year bond, assuming that U.S. still has a good rating and all those other things, you'd probably think it's probably close to 4 or 5%, maybe even 6%, if we are at long-term averages on the Fed funds rate. I am betting that with those fact patterns, you're not going to think and you're not going to say right then and there that Fed funds rates are at emergency levels, the stimulus required to really boost the economy in times of real stress at the 2.5 range. And probably you're not going to be telling me that the 10-year is at 2% and going lower. It's crazy. And it's even crazier that knowing this fact pattern and the information that's provided, that the Fed is now actually thinking and considering about lowering rates. The first, obviously, point comes up is why? Is there something out there that's lurking and it's really dangerous? Is there something out there that is, really concerning? I mean, it's not the markets. They're doing well. It's not credit spreads. No, there's plenty of liquidity in the system. I mean, it's kind of mind-blowing. I mean, so what gives? What is the deal? If you were that person, that castaway that was coming back, you would say, why? I don't get it. I don't understand what's happening. I mean, I think the explanation would have to be something like, hey, the problem goes back to we had this financial crisis, okay? And while the U.S. did a good job of fixing many of the problems and the underlying balance sheets of banks and the financial system, and we cleaned out a lot of the crap and the bad debt was kind of evaporated to a degree, and there was all these things that were done in terms of regulations in order to make sure that we didn't have any of these problems, and it took a number of years to get things right, but yet things are pretty good here. However, the same thing can't be said for example, Europe. And I think Europe's a big part of this problem right now. And you've heard me say this many times before. What Europe did was much different than what we did here in terms of fixing our financial system. What they did in Europe was pretty much like pouring a chocolate layer over a pile of dog poo. I mean, they basically just covered up the weakness to make it look better on the outside. But underneath it, still a giant pile of crap. And once that outer layer is exposed and there is something that happens that causes more problems, the weakness shows through once again. And in fact, even going beyond that, even going beyond the fact that they simply just covered up the mess and let all the problems really percolate under the surface, hoping that they go away one day. I mean, that's what they really think. Oh man, if we wait long enough and we throw enough money at it, and we don't change any of the way of doing things that we have currently in place that caused a lot of the problems, maybe time will just wash this all away. But you know what? They did a lot of things that actually hurt their financial system. They did bailouts for countries that they knew that couldn't pay back their debt. They bought bonds in countries and in places that they probably knew when they bought them, at the high price that they bought them, they'll never be able to pay back. They didn't care about quality. And then they threw the atomic bomb into the financial system. They decided to go with the experiment of negative interest rates, which essentially crippled their financial markets. And what it's doing is it's pushing investors and institutions to U.S. bonds, thereby artificially or forcibly raising the price of our bonds here and lowering the yields. So with that in mind, you can see that clearly that the yields in the U.S., this where we are today is not necessarily indicative of where the economics and the financial health of the United States really are. What it is more a reflection of what's happened in other markets and the prodding of money out of certain markets and into ours. And this negative yield policy within the Eurozone and Japan, by the way, and some other areas, but basically those two major markets, those two major economic superpowers, both Japan and the Eurozone, have been, I think, a big part of why rates are so low here and why we have to protect them. We do not want those financial institutions, whether it's Credit Suisse or Deutsche Bank or name any of the names over in Europe, to go down. We want to keep a little bit of that icing on top of the pile right now, because our banks are so integrated into their financial system as well that any problems that happen there are going to quickly move over here. And this is probably one of the reasons why banks in the U.S. and financials in the U.S., and particularly those that do a lot of business overseas, have not been doing as well as the markets itself, and why financials are a bit of a laggard. Even with lower rates, albeit a yield curve inversion and problems there and some concerns about the economy moving forward. But if we look what's happening in Europe, the breakdown of their economy and the problems that they're having there, and the fact that they will continue to utilize this negative interest rate policy, which is absolutely absurd because it hasn't sparked inflation, it hasn't solved the problems, and the ability to get out of that is pretty much non-existent. The unwind of that, it can't happen. We see what happens when we went about, 1% or so higher on interest rates here that were a positive interest rate to begin with. Can you imagine what happens when yields go the other way and they start rising in Europe? I mean, we saw the German Bund hit an all-time low. The 10-year hit a negative 0.3% last week. Negative 3.3%. 0.3%, just to be clear. That's unbelievable. Why would anybody put their money there except for the fact that you think that it's going to go even lower because the price on the bond will go higher? So there's something not right with the global economy, not so much the global economy in the aspect of where the economic numbers and reports lie, but moreover about the functionality and what central banks have done. And we talked about this recently last week or the week before. We talked about this with Danielle DiMartino Booth. We've had some great discussions about this, but I think it's really important at this point to understand what's happening with the markets and the expectation of markets for rates to come down, believing that we have a lot more room to go. So just a food for thought there on what's happening with markets right now and why the Fed is potentially going to be reducing rates, but realizing that it really doesn't have anything to do with the economic numbers here. It has everything to do with the foundation of the global central bank process and what they're doing to really try to have a synchronized stimulus program that will benefit everybody so that not one of the places will fall, thereby affecting all the others. So again, something to just put in the back of your hat there. I can't imagine with 100% chance of a rate cut in July and then a 67% chance in the next meeting after that, or the two meetings after that, that rates are going to go that much lower. I mean, there may be some movement here, especially if we see some geopolitical issues that really crop up and cause some more issues. But I'm hard pressed to really understand, unless the economy really starts to slow dramatically, and if the markets come down significantly, that we'll see anything that's even remotely like Europe. But again, I do think it is the tail wagging the dog right now, the Fed, and they're just following along, taking the cues from the markets rather than the markets taking their cues from the Fed. Moving along. I think I mentioned this before, but I want to mention it again to you. We've really been kicking it up on Fridays. I host an event each Friday morning at 9 a.m. for Trigger Charts. It's live. We go over the week ahead, what to look for, charts, technicals, great educational session. And what we do there is also take your symbols and take a look at them on the charts, look at market profiles and look at the volume-based indicators that really give us a great blueprint and footprint of where institutional traders are trading, where they're putting their money, and where they're putting their line in the sand. So if you want to attend that, we do a lot on TradeStation with that because we have these plugins for TradeStation. But you can sign up for that and register. I encourage you to do so. We'll put a link on the show notes for episode number 617 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I also had a busy week, by the way. I also held a webinar this week on Investology, the strategy we have, that hybrid robo-advisor, advisor-crafted, technology-enhanced solution that we came up with at your request, where we have a minimum investment of $10,000. I held a really cool webinar talking about the ins and the outs, the client portals, some of the investments, some of the way we are looking at markets, and you can get that replay over on Investology. And I'll put a link also in the show notes for this episode number 617. Now, before we go on to another area that I want to talk about, the notes from my luncheon with Ben Bernanke, I thought that it was really interesting that on Friday, the markets ended in the red and we saw that gold was continuing higher and cryptocurrencies were moving up, Bitcoin, et cetera, over $10,000 right now. It really looks like one of the things that you're seeing is the weekend that changed a little bit because of concern about some geopolitical upheavals that are looking like the root cause of what we saw. Again, it was a very good week, but Friday was kind of a weird day and fell towards the end where gold was holding up and equities kind of moved down. I want you to keep that in the back of your mind, the idea of geopolitical risks, because former Fed Chair Bernanke had a few things to say about that. And I was at a luncheon. I was invited to a luncheon on last Wednesday. It's about about 100 attendees, and it was down in Miami. I put up a picture of myself and Mr. Bernanke on Twitter. You could see that picture as well. But it's kind of interesting. I also recorded this, so we'll probably put some snippets out over the next couple of shows. But they started out as a PIMCO event. And I guess he's on the board of PIMCO, so he goes around speaking and talking for PIMCO. They invite him out. It was kind of a nice little, I think it was cozy, interesting discussion. A couple of chairs on the stage, big, fat, soft, comfy chairs on the stage. Somebody interviewing Bernanke. And they started the discussion, and PIMCO talked about the base case was this new normal in the environment of what we're seeing right now. They believe it's going to continue with low rates and low growth and a slow slog forward. But one of the things they talked about at PIMCO was, for the last 10 years, they create these base cases of what they see in markets. And remember, PIMCO is a major, they do equities, but bonds are their play. And in their base case over the last 10 years, until very recently, they didn't have any input regarding the potential for a recession. That's for the last 10 years. Now, in the latest update, in their base case, when they look at the probability range of where markets are going to be in the economy and recession, they actually added in a recession probability into their base case. And I kind of think that's kind of interesting. They don't think it's going to be a major one when we see it. It's not going to be like 2008, 2009, but rather a shallow, they use that word a couple times, shallow recession that will be like 2001, which was pretty much prompted by the dot-com burst. They see asset bubbles, but they're not excessive in the markets, which is kind of interesting to say, right? On one hand, you say the word asset bubble. On the other one, you say not excessive. And I always thought an asset bubble was an excessive positioning in the market. They talked about diversification and key versus the Barclay Ag, and there's no problems with spreads at this point, so therefore they can kind of go outside a little bit into the area of lower grade to reach for yield, because again, we're seeing spreads at this point in time right now different than we saw in December, a bit tighter than it's been. But let me go over the notes and kind of go through this, because I think there were some really interesting things in here that were discussed by Ben Bernanke. And I think it was what I found most fascinating about this was I was in agreement with a lot of things he said. When he was the Fed chair, I was like, oh gosh, where's he going with this? But remember, as a Fed chair, you're there as a cheerleader. Your job is to make sure that markets are feeling good, whether it's the bond market or the equity market. Your job is to make sure the economy is being pumped up as much as possible. Sentiment is high. Make sure that people can feel good about going out and shopping and buying things, and manufacturers will build up on inventories and the Fed's got your back. But when you step out and you're no longer a Fed governor, you can talk about things that seem a little bit more reasonable. So let's go over some of that. Interestingly, one of the first things he talked about was the idea that macroeconomic forecasting is not an exact science. So he started with the idea that he acknowledged that the Fed did not see any sign of the financial crisis coming. Which, when he said that, it kind of like, that being the case, why should I even trust any of your comments here? But nonetheless, let's go along with that. I thought it was an interesting admission. He said that the main reason for the global economic slowdown right now is China. Evidence that the U.S. is slowing down is definitely there. But again, kind of blaming it on China. He's been very surprised that the job growth in the United States has been so strong. And at the same time, he also said it's hard to see where the potential for a recession is coming, but there are some signs, but nothing major, as he believes that the bond market's not worried. And he talked about how, you know, what would be there as a sign that would maybe cause some of the recovery that we've seen in the last 10 years and the growth that we've seen to end. We're at a late part of the economic cycle by historical standards, kind of the 10-year mark right now. And he mentioned three basic ideas that could cause a problem. And he used the quote, he said, recoveries don't die of old age. They're murdered. And you either have the Fed raising rates that cause the economy to come to a grind to a halt, essentially. You have some type of existential financial crisis and possibly even some geopolitical events that could create risk-off behavior and markets drop, leading to a slowdown. So again, just reading the tea leaves of what he said there is that he admits again, and he's talking about how markets are a big part of the economic backdrop, and therefore it really tells us that the Fed is watching markets very closely, and they realize that there is a substantial need to make sure that markets behave well in order to ensure the economy itself also does well. Because a lot of things are tied to that, right? You have things like consumer confidence and sentiment. And you have the idea that, you know, companies can use their stock for various merger acquisitions and just a whole host of things that go into a heightened stock market. And the Fed is obviously on that. He said the most probable event, if you look on the horizon right now, that may be causing some concern in that there is a chance for recession is probably geopolitical. That's why I told you to remember that a moment ago, because he was talking about geopolitical issues due to the fact that there is a clear change over the last several years in the whole idea of globalization to more of undoing that. And his concern was that that is a big part of where the economy has gotten so much incredible amount of momentum that reversing that could be a problem. Now, when he talked about the Fed, and there was some discussion about this, he said that, you know, the Fed has now pivoted to a flat profile. In other words, non-stimulative or not trying to raise rates and slow down the economy. The rate where we are right now is a flat, a neutral stance overall. And that at the same time, which was interesting, he said, you know, while we have the Fed in this flat profile and where they're going to be patient, the markets are expecting a lot. And he doesn't believe that that's a good idea, that maybe an insurance cut could be out there. That's not the worst idea, but he wouldn't rule that out. Most likely it's going to be a status quo for a while. And the economy, if it is slowing, it's going to come into a soft landing. Inflation's not an issue. It's a little bit premature to do any kind of cuts at this point. It would look as though they're feeding markets. And they'll also look like they're capitulating to the president. He has no understanding how markets have an expectation of 3 to 4 rate cuts in the future. It seems wholly inappropriate. He also talked about the yield curve inversion. This is an area that he focused on a bit. He talked about the shape historically of a flat or inverted curve doesn't necessarily cause a recession. Rather, it is a sentiment of the bond market. Now, I don't know. You can talk about like the 8 of the past 9 recessions were preceded by an inverted curve. So I'm not exactly sure where he's going with this, but probably trying to downplay the idea that this time what we're seeing is or play into the idea that this time is different. We know how that works out. So he also commented about all the noise from the president. And he mentioned, and he was very adamant about the fact that the Fed's independence has been an important part of Fed operations, and the Fed will do everything that they can to be non-political. In fact, he said the current FOMC may actually want to lean the other way in some situations if they're getting prodded and poked and punched and tweeted at and all that. To really force the hand of showing that they are independent. He also mentioned this, and this is kind of interesting, that he believed that a lot of these tweets and a lot of the backlash that's going on from President Trump to the Fed is essentially only being used to set the Fed up for failure. In other words, they're the fall guy. If the markets don't do well and if the economy doesn't do well, it's all going to be blamed on the Fed. And obviously we're in, you know, election cycle here. Seems like we're always in an election cycle. But nonetheless, he really believed that this is going to be simply, well, the idea behind this is to be used as a fall guy. So that there could be some blame assigned. One of the things that the Fed's doing, he explained also, I thought this was really kind of cool. They're doing a review of all their tools and their policies. They're doing this at a good time because the economy's in a good place at the current time, and they may be looking to think about like QE And was that a good tool? Should we use it? Forward guidance, promising things in the future to guide or move markets. Negative rates. And he doesn't believe that they're going to be used in the U.S., at least at this time. But that's something that really that the Fed is not comfortable looking at. They may be looking at something like a yield curve control, what is going on in Japan right now, where they target a particular yield on a particular bond of the Treasury or their JGBs in Japan. And looking at possibly refinancing and finding banks to lend out money to the economy. So they're looking at some of these things to try to tweak, find new tools, looking to do something in the event there is some kind of craziness on the horizon. One of the other things that he really pressed was the idea that he's doing some studies on and looking into the possibility of changing the benchmark inflation idea of saying where we have now a 2% number that the Fed is looking at, you know, this idea that, hey, we need a 2% inflation rate before we really think that we could start increasing rates. And if we're at 1.8, well, that's not 2%. And therefore, blah, 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 blah. And where this 2% number came from is anyone's guess. But he's talking about now the idea that the Fed is looking at inflation averaging. So looking at, let's say, a two-year inflation average of where we are, and if we're a little bit below on the average for the last 2 years, and even if inflation picks up to 2.5% or 3% or 4%, if the average over the last 2 years has been low, and even though we're above it now, we're going to wait till the average picks up. So it may be 3, 6, 12 months into the future before such time where there's going to be actually an alert that's sounded in order to say that, okay, we hit our inflation target. So the inflation targeting that they've been using right now is a stagnant number that stays there and it's just static. That's it. Just stays right at 2%. That's the number we're looking at. And it's on a short-term basis, looking back maybe the last quarter. They're talking about now possibly using inflation averaging. Now, where this comes into play, by the way, is that the Fed now will be able to, without any backlash, if they determine that this is a direction they're going to go, to let an economy run hot or stimulate a lot more. Therefore, if you think about this, be more on the dovish side of things for a while. Now, where this can come into become a problem is where if you have inflation kicking up for a while and you're using a longer-term average, the Fed may, in fact, utilize that to increase rates much more than they would if they were just using a static number. Now, the problem with that is, the reality with that is that will not happen. Because once we get into the hot zone and once we see inflation averaging getting to the point where it looks like we should be increasing rates on a relative basis and markets start getting cranky and the economy slows down, they'll change back to a static number. They're just using this as an excuse, in my opinion, in order to simply justify rate decreases or staying at super low rates for a longer period of time if, in fact, inflation doesn't kick up. Rather than looking at why the fact is that the tools they're using are not at all spurring any significant inflation and why we have tariffs that clearly added a tremendous amount of excessive cost to many of the products that we are actually importing, how that has not increased the inflation. Now, with the recent move of the dollar down, will that potentially do something? Will we see that there is a difference in the inflation numbers now that the dollar is a bit weaker than it's been because we see the Fed is being much more dovish and the Trump administration is talking down the dollar? Yeah, we'll see. Bottom line is not to expect any radical change in the Fed process. That was his bottom line in all this. He also mentioned the last few years that there was a lot of worry about deficits, and right now there's less interest in this whole idea of running big deficits and massive debt because rates are low. So again, we're in a situation, whether this is MMT or whether this is simply an excuse to continue on providing stimulus, they're just not really too worried about this. It hasn't caused inflation. It hasn't caused any upheaval in the financial markets. Nothing's a problem right now. Now, when he switched over and was talking about the ECB, this was pretty interesting, I thought. He saw talk about how the ECB was really slow to use any tools. And this is why they're still in a tough situation. I believe not only were they slow to use tools, but they just didn't do the job, and they haven't done the job, and they're probably not going to do the job. They don't have the political ability to do so. They don't have the strength the way that their economy is set up with the ECB and the Eurozone. So he talked about they need help from fiscal policy, but that's almost impossible for the region. He talked about a change of leadership is coming because we see that Mario Draghi is going to be stepping down, I think in November, I think it is. And that's going to be a bit of a concern because, the continuity issue, what markets are expecting, the dovish nature of Mario Draghi could be, a little bit concerning. So there's something coming up we got to watch for. Inflation. He's surprised that in the U.S. inflation hasn't kicked up. With employment under 4% and showing limited inflation, that's a good thing. But why is that? We have neutral interest rates, which is kind of interesting that we haven't seen any major consequences from the lower rate. And he also believed that when it comes to inflation, the markets are not convinced and confident at all that inflation will get moving. Well, because it hasn't. None of the tools that have been used by the Fed, nor fiscal policy, tax cuts, none of this. Incredible amount of employment, wage hikes, tariffs, nothing is moving inflation. So markets are like, hey, you know what? This is not going to move. That's good. That then flows into the idea that, hey, the Fed is going to continue to keep rates really low because they don't have any risk. This is no risk involved here. Now, he finished up with a discussion about GDP. And when he talked about GDP, he said that one of the problems that we're having here in the U.S. is we're very similar to what went on and what has gone on in Japan, where we have an aging population, a big demographic shift. And the 2% growth rate is really due to that. We're seeing that because of this major demographic shift, the fact that there are much more older people in the economy than younger people, like we're seeing in Japan and what has happened, they're taking money out of the economy rather than putting money into the economy. And the lower interest rates and growth are very tied to the very notion of these demographic changes. And he referenced Japan a few different times. He talked about productivity in this whole area of GDP and that we could see some help with growth, but many of the things that could push growth are not showing up in the inflation numbers. For example, they're actually disinflationary, like technology innovation and things like, utilizing, like ride sharing. So many things in the tech revolution are not capital intensive, rather capital savings. And this whole idea of what's gone on and some of the revolution that we've seen in technology and advancements in so many areas that has spawned off of this technology revolution has really, unfortunately, not helped productivity necessarily. It's probably helped productivity in a very big way, but because of the way the technology leverages the tools to get there, it's not showing up in the traditional metrics. And he talked about how we may have to redefine what productivity is and how to actually calculate productivity. If in fact there is no way to really assign the benefits from certain things. Like for example, with ride sharing, people need, there are less cars needed on the road. So in theory, what's happening is with less cars on the road, therefore there is more productivity because you don't have to drive and move around. So you're more productive and possibly could do things in the car as you're driving because you don't have to drive. However, at the same time, not as much cars need to be manufactured. So that drops productivity. Just one example of a very simple example of what he's talking about this whole productivity conundrum. So it was an interesting time. I mean, he pretty much right after that was escorted out not a few questions and answers, a few things that were able to be asked, but basically his 1 hour time limit was up and that was it. But a really, I think a really good discussion, why I brought it to you was because I thought some of the details were really in line with what we've been talking about for some time, this whole idea of, you know, productivity being an issue and the Fed being really focused on markets and the pull forward effect. He did talk about that, and that's probably going to see some reflexive market economic reaction moving forward, and the whole idea of Europe and Japan and where we're going with all this. So I think there was some really good tidbits in this discussion. Hopefully I didn't bore you to pieces with it because I thought it was pretty fascinating, but that really goes into play with what we're looking at here. A couple of points and we'll close it up. I think next week we have, GDP, the third, we have the Case-Shiller Home Price Index on Tuesday. We have consumer confidence coming out. We also have GDP coming out at the end of the week, the third revision to GDP that will be there. So keep an eye on that. And of course, we're going to kind of try to wade through the week with whatever's going on geopolitically with Iran. We're going to attack them. They're not going to attack them. We're going to say we're going to shoot one bullet. They're going to shoot 10 bullets. We're going to hit them and try to work on the economic side of things. That's the big thing right now, right? We're working on economics with all these countries, making them, you know, make Iran great again through economic benefits if they play along with us. Once again, a miscalculation by our current administration, because certain established, so the general nature of people around the world is not all about money. There are some societies that really respect other things much more, whether it's education, whether it's religion. They're not looking at money and they're not looking at just getting wealthy. Some of them really actually look down on the whole idea of, you know, incredible wealth. And that being the case, you have to wonder if these tactics are going to work on them. You know, right now we're in the Middle East talking about, you know, economic benefits of doing all this. And that's what they're going to tie the whole peace treaty on. And we're talking about that with Iran. Of course, the same thing with North Korea. But some of these regimes and some of these societies don't really work and aren't affected by that as much as others are. I just think we're barking up the wrong tree. All right, with that, we're going to close the show. Of course, Tuesday nights with John C. Dvorak, live and streaming, if I can make sure to get this rig working correctly, and we'll bring in a couple of engineers to help us with that. I'll tell you, I'm not doing that myself. No way I can do that. I don't think. Maybe. But we'll be live with John C. Dvorak on DH Unplugged on Tuesday evening. Make sure to go over to dhunplugged.com and check out what's going on over there. Fun stuff. Really great show. Really interesting. Much different layout than we do here. A lot less serious. Over there, it's game time. So check out DH Unplugged. And of course, we're here to manage and help you and invest for you and with you and understand more about you. So if you think it's maybe time that, take on a different strategy, look at a long-short strategy with TDI Managed Growth Strategy or Investology, $10,000 minimum. You can go on Investology, by the way, and you can start crafting your own portfolio. You don't have to worry about, investing at this point. Just kind of craft the portfolio. Go through the questionnaires. See what it's all about. Investology.com. Other than that, I'm going to end it right here. And I hope you have a great weekend. I'll see you next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.